Okay, good morning. I'll just have a late start. So, last time was a review of topics from sort of basic networks. And so we looked at, a very abstract level, the idea that networks were providing communication services, and then that these services were used by data applications, and the data applications would have certain needs and wants with regards to the delivery. And so matching that to the network isn't necessarily that easy. So networks introduce problems like loss, delay, and variability of delay into data delivery, and dealing with that can be problematic. Okay. Historically, we said there were two main types of networks, voice networks and packet networks, computer networks, and that these were designed in a way that sort of optimized the delivery of or a certain type of data or provided the qualities, delivery qualities that a certain type of data might prefer. So voice networks provided circuit switch, so connection-oriented delivery. Packet networks did not. They used packet switching, statistical multiplexing, so it optimized the use of the resources, but introduced waiting to and delay into the network. Okay. And so there's again a couple of big design elements to networks. There's how you allocate the resources. So do you pre-allocate them end to end? Or do you try and optimize their usage by allocating them link by link on a first come, first serve basis? Okay. Within data networks, the protocols are arranged in a layered fashion, so you have a stack of protocols, each of which is concerned with certain tasks, and those tasks serve the neighboring layers, the layer higher up. Okay. So, when we say wireless networks, what we tend to be thinking about point-to-point wireless link. So whether that's usually an access link, possibly if you have an ad hoc network, then you can have multiple wireless links. Most of what we're going to consider really is just that first hop from the user into the network. And obviously what we need to do is explore what's the difference between that first link being wired and wireless. And so we'll start that exploration today. And we're just going to, again, look at what we need to do, what are the various elements that support transporting digital data, so transporting bits over a wireless link. And so in terms of references, a lot of the basic stuff we're doing, and the wireless networking stuff we do, will come from William Stallings, and it's getting a bit old at this point, but it does talk about the basics of sort of wireless networking pretty well. It's very readable. These notes come from chapters 6 and 8 primarily. What it's not going to have much of a discussion on are more modern wireless techniques. So for you'll talk a lot about, we'll talk about basic multiplexing techniques, but you won't get, for instance, MIMO or things like that. So later on in the module, we'll sort of address those with separate references. Okay, there are a lot of radio comms books out there. And so, again, the comms stuff is pretty stable, and these will give a lot more detail in Stallings, more than we necessarily need in this module. Okay. So what we're going to look at today is what it takes to send a message over a single radio link, okay? And for our purposes, the message could just be a packet, but we'll also be spending some time looking at voice applications as well. Okay. And so if you think about having a voice application, well, the first thing you're going to need to do is to digitize it. So you have an analog digital converter. Then you may wish to reduce the number of bits that you're transmitting. Again, wireless resources tend to be scarce, and so the more efficiently you can send your signal, the better. And so, say, a little bit about compressing voice signals. Okay. Having done that compression, well, wireless channels can also be lossy, so what do you do to combat loss? Well, you're going to want to add redundancy. And so a channel encoder is a way of adding an amount of redundancy to either find out that your signal is an error or try to correct that error. Then you have to decide how you're going to represent your bits. So you have to represent them as a sine wave, essentially, some variation on a sine wave. So there's a number of ways to do that. And finally, you have to transmit over the radio channel. Okay. So for today, we're going to concentrate on all these bits that happen before the radio channel. And next Thursday, we'll look at what happens within the radio channel. Okay. So again, what we're thinking of is sending bits from a sender to a receiver, from a source to a sink, and the physical medium is via a radio link. And again, as I said, that's a sinusoidal signal, and so some sort of modification of a sinusoid. Okay. All of the information has to eventually be digital. It may come to you originally digital, so as a packet from an application, or in the case of voice, it, you know, the voice signal has to be digitized. So if you have a telephone, the telephone will first digitize your voice signal. Okay, and so again, we have this number of steps that we need to get the our original message into the form that we're going to transmit it. So we start again by, if we have a voice signal, an analog signal, we digitize it. We then use a source encoder to compress possibly that signal. A channel encoder adds some redundancy so that we can combat the effects of loss. The modular will convert this digital information into a waveform representation, and then again, that waveform is transmitted over a radio link. Okay. So, again, there's different techniques that apply to that at each of these stages, and we'll go over some of those today. And again, in terms of our message, we have pretty much in the back of our mind right now is a voice signal. Okay, so we should know pretty much how voice is digitized. The piece of data, which is the sample signal, but we'll then look at how we can arrive at lower bit rate signals representing the same thing, so how we can compress our signal. Okay. Again, we've looked at, most of you should be familiar with block coding, so things like parity bits, CRCs, Hamming codes, and so while I'll mention them, we're not really going to spend much time on them. We will look at sort of more sophisticated techniques like convolution coding, and the plus of convolution coding is that it allows for some forward error correction. Okay. So if there is an error, you can try and reconstruct your signal. So if you have a lossier system. Okay, and we'll look at digital modulation techniques. Now, one of the things that we're concerned with in that is what sort of performance you can get out of your system. And so we'll look at a few performance measures. Look at channel capacity. So, given certain characteristics of your channel, at what bit rate can you actually transmit? And then also error rates. So, if you're using a typical certain modulation technique, your channel has certain characteristics, what's the probability that your bits arrive either intact or in error? Okay, so we'll start with this idea of performance. And here there is a limit to the amount of information we can send in a given time, or the rate at which we can send information. This limit is introduced by noise. noise can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. The classic one that we'll start with is that the noise is something on the channel, okay? And so there are a number of possible sources for this noise, and again, the one that we're concerned with is theoretical. Channel is the thermal noise or white noise. Okay, so just if noise exists in the atmosphere. Okay. This is uniformly distributed across the spectrum. There's a noise density, which is the noise that can be found in 1 kilohertz of bandwidth, and this is dependent on temperature. Okay. So it will change depending on the temperature. Other noises are introduced just by the system itself. So you can have intermodulation noise. So when you have signals sharing the same medium, those signals can combine in sort of unpredictable ways to either bolster each other or cancel each other out. And indeed, we'll see next time is even if you have a single signal over a radio transmitter, can bounce off various objects, you can end up with multiple copies of the same signal arriving at your receiver, and again, either interfering or not with each other. Okay. And in wired systems, you can have crosstalk, so signals on wires sort of interfering with each other, and also you can have impulse noise, you know, like a lightning strike or whatever, something that's unpredictable and wipes out your signal altogether. Okay. Now, if we consider our first type of noise, our thermal noise, then we can say something about channel capacity. And in particular, we have the Shannon's capacity theorem. Okay. And what Shannon proved was that the channel capacity, so the number, the bit rate at which you can transmit data, is limited, and it's a function of the channel bandwidth, so in hertz. And the signal-to-noise ratio. And so that's the signal-to-noise ratio is the average signal power over the average noise power. Okay. So, if you look at an extreme, if you had no signal, so this would be zero, you get the log of one, which is zero, and you'd have no capacity. As your signal strengthens, obviously you can send more bits faster. You can send your bits faster. Okay. This is a theoretical result. And so what it says is there's some way of forming up your bits that you can do this, but finding it might not be that. But like, so what it does is it gives you an upper bound on how that's the bit rate at which you can send your signal. Okay. A lot of times, this result is specific to noise, but other imprecisions of the system in terms of coding and modulation. Typically, people tend to represent them as additional noise factors. Ones which either sort of bolster the signal-to-noise ratio or lower the signal-to-noise ratio. And we'll see a little bit of that as we go through. Okay. So, frequently, there's just, a thing to look out for. Frequently, your signal-to-noise ratio will be expressed in decibels. So, a decibel is 10 log 10 of your quantity. And so, for instance, to use it in Shannon's capacity theorem, you have to convert out of decibels. That's just something, that's a little sidebar. Something to be aware of. Okay, so your signal-to-noise ratio is your average signal strength power over your average noise power. There's a second quantity which is frequently used with regard to digital transmission, so the transmission of bits, and this sort of relates those quantities to the transmission of a single bit. Okay. And this quantity is EB over N0, and so EB is the signal energy per bit, so it's how much energy there is in transmitting, again, a single bit to noise power density per hertz. Okay. Now, this can be related to the signal-to-noise ratio. So, if you have signal bandwidth of Vt, then the noise is N0 Vt, and the signal energy per bit is S over R, where R is your data rate. Okay. And so using that, you relate your EB over N0 to your signal to noise ratio. And so EB is S over R, and we can convert the N to the term, the factor of N0, so N is, again, is what it is per hertz times the number of hertz you have available, so your bandwidth, and so if you take your N and multiply the top and bottom by Pt, you get to then isolate out your N0 Vt, and that becomes, that term 1 over N0 becomes Vt over N. Okay. So then you pull together your signal-to-noise ratio, S over N, and you have this additional factor of Vt over R. Okay. Now, 1 over that factor, R over Vt, is what's known as the bandwidth deficiency. And if you think of it, it tells you how much the signal you, or how much transmission you can pack into a specific bandwidth. Okay. So obviously you want your rate to be as high as possible. So the higher R is relative to Vt, the higher your signal efficiency. Okay. So you get a higher bit rate out of the same bandwidth.
Is that the same as?
didn't know. Sorry. I'd have to look up. Probably is, but... Okay, so similar concept, spectral efficiency of the channel is the ratio of the channel capacity to the channel bandwidth. And again, we can relate that to our E zero. And so using channel's capacity, we have what the signal noise ratio is in terms of our channel capacity over bandwidth, and then B is BT from before, C is R, and then we can relate EV over M0 to channel capacity and bandwidth. Okay. And so we can use that to determine a desired spectral efficiency. Okay, we'll be returning to this later. It factors in for us, EV over N0 factors in for us mainly in its relation to modulation techniques. So depending on what modulation technique you use, for the same EV over N0, you get different, for instance, loss rates and different spectral efficiencies. Okay, so the EV over N0 is what we're going to sort of have following through us as we go through this lecture, and that'll be our performance measure, and again, it's then related to other performance measures. What we're going to do now is go through each of the components in turn, so our analog to digital encoder, our source encoder, our channel encoder, our modulator, and again, just look at its sort of in the context of wireless systems. Okay, so everyone should have seen your standard, what's called pulse code modulation technique for digitizing voice. And so the gold standard of voice encoding is 64 kilobits per second rate. And this comes from the Nyquist sampling theorem, which states that an analog signal can be fully recovered if it's sampled at twice the signaling bandwidth. And so the bandwidth for voice is 4,000 hertz, and so you need to sample at a rate of 8,000 samples per second. Now that would be an exact sample. Obviously, we need to represent these samples somehow, and digitally in this case, and we use 8 bits per sample to represent our levels. Okay. Sampling and digitization in this fashion is referred to as pulse code modulation. Now, when we digitize our voice sample, obviously we only have a finite number of levels to choose from, so we get what's called quantization noise, so we have a slight error creeping into the system. Again, not one that anybody would notice, but there is a slight error. Again, sometimes people will lump that error into their representation of the signal to noise ratio. Okay. Now, obviously, if your sample is outside of your 4 kilohertz range, then you lose those values. Okay, so this is an example using 4 bits to quantify your sample. And so, again, you will be sampling periodically. And if you look, obviously, at each sample point, you're not going to be exactly at your quantization level, so you have to pick the closest level. Okay. Now, some techniques can be used to sort of improve the quality of the signal. One is what's called nonlinear encoding. And so the idea here is that the amplitude of your signal is possibly increasing and decreasing. And so if you have a low amplitude signal, you still want to recover as much as you can of the shape of that signal. So you introduce more encoding levels at the lower end and then less at the higher end. Okay. Okay. So again, that 64 kilobits per second is the gold standard. Now, when cellular telephony first came on the scene, well, first it was analog signals being transmitted. When the signals became digitized, 64 kilobits per second was quite a lot to be sending. So again, there were efforts to reduce the size of the amount of data that had to be transmitted, so those signals were compressed. Okay, and so a source encoder is what's used to compress your signals. Okay. Now, any encoding can either introduce loss or not. Okay, typically loss-free encoding is a bit more complex to achieve. So for voice, we're going to look at sort of two classes of encoding techniques. The first class just tries to keep this idea of sampling your signal, but be clever about how you represent those samples. In particular, rely on the fact that between one sample and the next, you're probably not going to move too much. You're not going to jump the whole range. Therefore, if you look at the difference between one sample and the next, you can probably represent that difference using less bits. Okay. The second attempt or the second class moves away from this idea of sampling to representing voice as some sort of parameterized function where you now need to send the proper parameters instead of the actual voice sample. Okay. Okay. So, in our first class, where we're trying to reduce the amount of information we need to send samples, we'll have a number of different techniques, which first of all rely on, again, sending the difference between one sample and the next, and then sort of see how much we can reduce the amount of information we're sending. Okay. Yeah, the answer is you can reduce it quite a lot, but your quality will eventually start suffering a lot. Okay. We'll then again just mention that there are other techniques available. These techniques, again, rely on representing your voice signal as a function and sending the parameters of that function, and you get much reduced data rates, although again, you do sacrifice something in terms of voice quality. Okay. So, again, differential post-pulsecode modulation assumes that the difference between one sample and the next is not going to be overly large, and therefore we can code it. We don't have as big a range. We can code it in less bits. Okay. So our simplest codec. We'll send 6 bits instead of 8. There is loss, obviously, introduced in doing this if, again, the signal jumps too much in any given time. Okay, so adaptive BPCM tries to be a bit cleverer and use not only just the difference between the signals, but also the trend. Okay, so again, things tend to go up and down and up and down. So if you look at a number of previous signals, then you can make a better prediction of your next signal as well. Okay. And so you again transmit the difference between the signals, but then when trying to determine that at the other end, you also use sort of the history. And yeah, you can adapt your quantization levels. So again, you're still trying to recreate your original sampled, the original samples. Okay. So, one extreme example of DPCM is what's called delta modulation. And in delta modulation, your signal either goes up or down by one each time, by one level each time. Okay. And what you can see, the are drawing any curve and see how closely you can fit, you know, thing to the curve going up or down. And you'll see that what you get is, you know, you'll get the basic trend, but, you know, there's a significant gap between what you actually see and, or what it actually was and what you're able to transmit. Okay. So you get large quantization errors. You can prove, obviously, by increasing your sampling rate, so more frequently you're able to adjust the closer you're going to stay to the curve. The plus of it is that, you know, you're sending something very simple, you're just saying go up, go down.
Okay.
And typically it's like, you know, you can still get sort of decodable, as an, you know, interpretable voice signal at about 16 kilobits per second. It's used primarily just in military applications where you aren't concerned with quality except to make sure that, you know, the message can be heard, but it doesn't have to be pleasant or anything. Okay. So, again, if you can sample again at 64 kilobits per second, everybody's pretty happy with the signal. If you don't want to send at quite that rate, you can try to compress the representation of those samples, and that goes a certain way towards getting your data rate down. An alternative to this is, again, to try and model the voice as in a parameterized fashion, and then periodically transmit the parameters for the model. And so you transmit your parameters, and then at the receiver receives those parameters and synthesizes the voice from the model and the parameters. Okay. So you can get interpretable signals at up to, you know, bit rates of down to 4.8 kilobits per second, but they won't be great. So the first technique to use this was linear predictive coding. And so, again, we have this idea of a parameterized model. Okay, and the parameters are transmitted every 20 milliseconds. Okay, so what is sent? Well, you have your symptoms of loudness, whether it's voice or silence, pitch, and sort of vocal tract coefficients. And so, again, for each of those, there's a mathematical model involved. And so you synthesize your vocal cord and vocal tract then and combine it all to send out your signal. Okay, so the vocal cord synthesizer generates a series of impulses. The unvoiced synthesizer is white noise. Your vocal tract model, again, this is a filter to synthesize the sound. Anyway, so you have all these coefficients which go to, into these mathematical models. Okay. And they reproduce the your vocal signal up to a point, and in general, your LVCs are considered to be fairly unattractive sounds. Kelp, code excited linear prediction, builds on LVC to give you a more natural sound, and basically it does this by sort of analyzing the bits that are left out of the model, out of the LVC model, and having a code book of typical residuals, so typical bits that could be added in. And then, in addition to the basic model parameters, you send a reference to the code book and say, you know, add this bit in. Okay, so again, just pick out this code book. Okay, and so those sorts of systems are typically used in mobile phones, and it seems to be a good trade-off between quality and data rates. Okay, so now you have a stream of data you want to send. This could be your voice signal, or this could be just packets that you want to transmit. And so the two steps left are to make the bits more robust to loss, more robust to error. And so you do that with channel encoding, so you add some redundancy so that you can deal with errors. And then to form the bits into some sort of sinusoidal signal. Okay, so channel coding is used to either detect or correct errors. And the way you do that is you have to add some redundancy into your signal. Okay, so the last thing we talked about with the voice coding was how you reduce the number of bits you're sending. Now you're going to start adding bits in, but with the thought that it's better to add some overhead and be able to actually fix your signal. Okay. Now, what you would have seen in your typical data networks module is the way that errors were dealt with is you detected them, and then once they were detected, you trash the packet and just ask for the packet to be resent, or trash the packet and didn't worry about it, depending. But typically, errors were dealt with by retransmission. That's not always desirable, and so in some cases, you might want to do forward error correction. You might want to actually try and fix the signal that you're receiving. And particularly in things like the streaming transmissions, voice transmissions. It's no use resending it. It's no use resending data, so it's better to fix it up if possible. And so, depending how you set up your redundancy how much information you get from your redundancy, you may or may not be able to do this fix. Okay. So again, what you would have seen before is, well, we break up our data into chunks, let's say k bits, so we have 2 to the k possible combinations of bits, and then we add on additional code bits, okay? And the goal of adding on these additional code bits was that you increase the Hamming distance, which meant that you had to change more bits in order to get to a legitimate combination. So if you had no redundancy, then any bit you changed just got you back to a perfectly legitimate code word, okay? So there's no way, if you have no redundancy, there's no way of knowing if what you sent is right or wrong, because everything's possible, okay? You start adding your redundancy, and suddenly not everything's possible. What goes with one combination, for instance, what if there's a different code word for each combination? And anytime you change one bit, at least, you know that there was something wrong. And I just stepped on the table. Come back to me. Okay, so what have I done wrong? Okay, so this was a little earlier than I intended to stop, but since I have technical difficulties, we'll stop now, take our 15-minute break, and I should be able to fix it by then.